This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Book of Serenity, Case 23. Rosso faces the wall. Preface. Bodhidharma's 9 years are known as wall gazing. Shinko's 3 prostrations are outflowings of heavenly activity. How can the traces be swept away, the footprints eliminated? The case. Whenever Rosso saw a monk coming, he would face the wall. Hearing this, Nansen remarked, "I always tell others to receive directly, even before the empty kalpa, to realize themselves even before the Buddha came into the world. But still, I haven't found half a man, let alone a whole man. If he is thus, he'll be stuck in the ear of the donkey." The verse. Plain water has flavor, subtly transcending the senses. It precedes forms, though seemingly endlessly to exist. The way is precious, though seeming massively to be foolish. Inscribed designs in a jewel, and its glory is lost. A pearl, even from an abyss, naturally beckons. Plenty of bracing air purely burnishes autumn's swelter. Far away, a single tranquil cloud divides sky and water. Whenever Rosso saw a monk coming, he would face the wall. When we hear this, it's easy to think that Rosso was refusing to answer the monk's questions. But rather than think of what he's doing as a refusal of some kind, perhaps we should see it as a response. I think in many koans, we can see this distinction. A monk comes looking for an answer, but what he gets is a response. And this is fundamentally a very different thing. I thought of this koan in light of our recent discussions of Martin Buber's I and Thou. And the question arose is that, is Rosso refusing an encounter or offering one? If a monk comes with a mere question, something that can have an explanation or an answer, in a way, he's trying to enter into a I-it kind of relation. He's looking for a piece of knowledge. He's looking for a fact. Looking for something that solves a riddle or solves a problem. Perhaps Rosso is offering a radical response. We see this in so many cases. A monk asks in all earnestness, "Does a dog have Buddha nature?" When Joshu says "mu," he's giving a response, not an answer. When a monk gets hit or shouted at, he's getting a response where he was looking for an answer. Gutai holds up one finger. Rosso faces the wall. What does a response do that an answer doesn't? As in a kind of I and thou encounter, there's a different kind of immediacy in reality and finality to a response. This is it. Question is not answered, but the whole foundation of the question, the premises of the question, are undercut. This is our experience of practice over the years. We come with all sorts of questions, but we don't get answers to those questions. But what then happens to them? We're told we must solve the great problem of life and death, the great matter. What exactly is the problem of life and death? Is there an answer to it? What would that even mean? It's not that the problem is unreal, it's more that its resolution is the dissolving rather than an answering. Why is there birth and suffering and death? There is birth, there is suffering, there is death. Responses turn us back on ourselves, turn us back to the reality of this moment. Yet I think it's also a mistake to think that Rosso's turning his back on the student and facing the wall is leaving the student alone with the problem. As I said in my opening remarks, we're mistaken if we think that practice is something we're doing alone. The whole idea of a practice entails the idea of participation in something. Partaking of a tradition, a form of life, kind of disciplined activity that we are invited to join, invited to train ourselves within this practice. Like the practice of medicine, it's bringing us into a whole body of knowledge, a whole way of being, a whole system of thinking and doing and engaging with others. I've had an ongoing debate with a number of my students and others over the years about the question of whether there's such a thing as pure awareness. The idea that in meditation, we go through a process of continual subtraction. So we no longer are our body, our thoughts, our emotions, our sensations. And when we look what's behind those things, we see just awareness without content. And while I think it's probably the case that people can induce all sorts of strange kinds of consciousness in themselves through various practices, the idea of pure awareness is ultimately extremely dualistic. We have this inner pristine awareness, and then there's the world out there that will somehow make its imprint on our consciousness. But when we think that awareness is always intentional, always awareness of something, what we realize is that there is no awareness apart from the world. There is no inner apart from an outer. There's no self apart from relation. And this, to me, is the fundamental antidote to that delusion of aloneness or separateness, that everything that we are and everything we do is fundamentally and inescapably a participation. We do not precede the active participation. Instead, we're constituted by it. If we don't have a sense of that participation, when Rosso turns his back and faces the wall, it can seem simply as a rejection, a refusal. We don't experience it as an encounter unless we are participating in a whole way of being together in this practice, where we can then see it as a response. We have to be part of a language and form in order to see Gutai's raising one finger as a response rather than an empty gesture. So much of what we do in life is go around looking for answers. Sometimes we can find them, sometimes we can't. But practice has the potential for turning that around and allowing us to see the world as responding rather than answering or refusing to act, to answer. What are the questions you still have? What would count as an answer? What would be an appropriate response? I would just say one more thing about that idea of an appropriate response. Rosso's name is not very familiar to us. We have many more stories about Joshu and Uman and Rinzai. We remember their words. And it's not that Rosso's response was in some sense wrong, but one wonders how attuned was that response to the monks that came to him, because again, if we think in the spirit of I and thou, part of the teacher's responsibility is not just to be right, but in some way to be compassionately helpful, to meet the student in a place where the student can actually be transformed. The danger, of course, in a one-size-fits-all response is that it substitutes some absolute sense of correctness for any empathy or understanding of where the student is coming from. This is where some skillful means have to come in, and the skillful means most of the time use some words. In the preface and the verse here, there's a way in which we are asked to see the perfection of this kind of presentation of the absolute. The preface asks, how can the traces be swept away, the footprints eliminated? As if any elaboration, let alone explanation, of the meaning of Rosso's response is a contamination of its clarity and its purity. But the reality is that usually we have to be willing to walk through the mud and leave lots of traces if we're going to meet people where they are. So when you come to Dokusan, I will not just face the wall. Maybe someone somewhere would awaken in response to that, but for most of us, we need some mixture of answer and responsiveness. This is how we come down into the real world and engage one another in a compassionate activity rather than simply respond with the purity of the absolute. But when we get too caught up in our questions, too entangled in our search for answers, it's good once in a while to be reminded of the pure response of Mu, of one finger, of Roso facing the wall.